Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 125. With Dave Orloff and I discussing financing rentals or fix and flip deals. If this is your first time with us here, checking out the REI Diamond Show, I'd like to take a brief moment to welcome you to the show. This is the No Fluff, No BS real estate investing show dedicated to digging out the real estate investment jewels of wisdom from our guests. There is no sales pitch, no coaching, and no other products to buy. This is not a webinar. This is just real-world money-making ideas for you to implement into your own real estate investing business. Today's show with Dave of American Heritage Lending focuses on a general discussion of the U.S. real estate market with an emphasis on the lowest cost, lowest risk financing methods available for landlords, fix and flip investors, or any combination thereof. And Dave and I are going to make a few predictions as to where we think the real estate market in the U.S. is going in 2019. If you've been a fan of the REI Diamond Show for a while, you know I don't tolerate BS. So please understand that when I invited Dave to come on the show, I did so because I knew he'd be a great guest, bringing solid real estate investing experience to the table, in addition to some unbelievable, unique investor loan products, including a 40-year amortized rental loan with a 40-year term. Do you think the prices of the real estate you're buying are going to be higher or lower 40 years from now when that loan is paid off? I've never heard of such a product before today, but I can think of quite a few scenarios to use such a loan to ride over the very long-term appreciation in certain markets while maximizing my cash flow in the interim due to the lower payment a 40-year amortization schedule brings. Well, enough about what I do with the loans. Let's jump right in with Dave. All right, Mr. Dave Orloff, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So for posterity's sake, it's January 30th, 2019. And out the window of my condo here where I record these episodes is Lake Michigan in Chicago. And today was the record-breaking, in a bad way, weather that I think anyone's ever had. It's colder than Antarctica, and it looks like there's clouds coming off the lake. It was like negative 19 when I woke up this morning. And I'm wondering, how much better is your weather out there in California, Dave?
It's painful to have to tell you that it's freezing here. It's about 55 degrees and, you know, we have jackets on. We're going to stay inside all day. And it's funny, you should be located where you're located. Our human resources and compliance person is located in Chicago. And she said, you know, our high today is going to be minus 21. And it's considered instant frostbite if you go outside today. So, boy, our thoughts are with you guys. Stay safe. Sunny Southern California is freezing today at about 55 and cloudy.
Nice. Well, it is what it is. So cool. Dave, Southern California is where you're hailing from and the market that you're in. We here at the REI Diamond Show are primarily real estate investors. We fix and flip. We build new construction. We hold rental property. We do real estate to make a profit. Knowing that, and I invited you to come on the show because I knew a little bit about your background as an investor and also in the mortgage business. But could you give the listeners, the audience here, the backstory about, you know, how you got started in real estate, what your career professionally kind of, you know, matured into where, you know, in addition to the real estate investing, you're also the CFO of American Heritage Lending. So what was that path like for you, the Reader's Digest version?
I appreciate that. I'll try and keep it quick. I started investing in real estate in 2001, so coming up on my 20-year mark. And that transition really started as, you know, a buy-and-hold investor. We went through the crisis just like everybody else and came out the other side of that to really scale up our fix and flip business. So we acquired a lot of property here, you know, we're kind of in and out of those on an average of 6 months. So more of a cosmetic than a ground up. And then currently, we were just chatting, Dan, offline, that our investment philosophy, because of the prices of homes here relative to rents, the property that we've acquired, we've sort of focused on the vacation rental market. So we hold a portfolio of properties that we rent out on a short-term basis, you know, a nightly basis, and that's really just to kind of keep up with, you know, what it costs to get into an asset relative to what they rent for on a long-term basis. It's hard to have any type of positive cash flow out here. So that's what we're doing. And then in 2008, my business partner and I formed American Heritage Lending, and our specialty at that point was just traditional mortgage banking, which we've then segued the business and partnered with a real large hedge fund out of New York over the last year or two to focus on a market of or for real estate investors doing long-term rental loans, doing fix and flip product, lending on that, and even some ground up stuff. That kind of rounds out my experience over the last 17 years.
Nice. We're definitely going to spend some time talking about the loans and the lending portion of it. But before we do, I want to back up a second here to the vacation rentals. Some of the audience knows, has listened to recently, we had Scott Shatford of Air DNA, I believe the company is, who's like a data provider for some of that. He was on, I'll reference the in the show notes there, that previous episode. We had on a few other people who are doing management and also work in that strategy. And I personally have one apartment unit that I put into service, and it was great for the first, this is only 4 months old. For the first 2 months, the thing was booked nonstop. And the guys tell me, yeah, it's going to be a problem in the wintertime. We've had two bookings for the last 2 months. It was kind of like, yeah, the air deflated. I'm not as excited, but I'm committed to ride through one more year and see what the numbers actually bear out to. Because I probably got twice, maybe three times the revenue compared to the rent there, you know, in that month or two. But I think it's a great strategy, and I think it definitely helps offset, justify, potentially even revalue, or, you know, the properties that you're hanging on to. I'm curious, Southern California, prices are nuts. That's what we all hear, you know, on the other end of the country here where it's cold today. Here,
right.
Are you actually making profits from the vacation rentals, or is your investment philosophy surrounding basically grabbing the property, hanging on to it for a period of time, mostly breaking even to, you know, an exit where the appreciation wave continues on your behalf?
So I really think that's a great question. As a younger guy, I did some investment with my family, and, you know, looking back now, I think I've really coined that more speculation where, you know, we bought a house, put a renter in it, you know, broke even until the market appreciated, and it worked. But it gave me, as a true investor, it gave me a little bit of concern as I reflected on that as an older guy. Speculating is hard because you never really know where markets are headed, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that later. But the vacation rental play for us in the beginning, which started in 2013, we're on about our fifth year, no question about it, Dan, was highly profitable. And I'd say where it measured out even after expenses was almost double what you'd see on an annualized basis from long-term leasing. Today, with competition and some silly behavior out of the large listing sites that we all present our properties on that have caused price, you know, compression and even margin compression on the back end, we're doing better than breaking even, but it isn't a business that is making enough profit that I think is highly scalable based on the asset values here in California.
Yeah, that's a great point. And some of why my rental, I believe, fell off was the big sites. We in Chicago, there's like a license. So the city requires you to get this, you know, bed and breakfast license or whatever it's called. The manager handled this for me. I don't actually self-manage that unit. And okay. We applied for that license. We had our listing up and we started to have that momentum I described in the beginning, the first 2 months we were up, and it was looking like it was going to keep going. We had good reviews, people were booking, it seemed like the bookings were coming continuously, and then it stopped, and the listing site pulled our listing completely, reset, deleted, no reviews, nothing, because the way the application was put in, it said something like it was a second floor unit instead of unit two. So there was a typo in the application. They pulled it. We started back over a week later, got the license was awarded, but for whatever reason, it didn't match. And then it's been, you know, crickets ever since. So the risk for me of being beholden to the sites, to the marketplace, in a sense, where an algorithm change can, you know, knock me off, I agree 100%. I have no intention on scaling that, you know, to 10 units from one, or to, from one unit to 20 or to 100 units. There's no way I think that there's just too much risk for me to scale that up beyond what I have already. I mean, I feel like I'm right. Is there some agreement there, or would you say, you know, that I'm off base in viewing that risk there, Dave?
I would agree 100%. We're a little bit more pot committed. We have sold a couple of our properties. We are absolutely beholden to the listing sites, and it took us the better part of 6 months to figure out that even an algorithm had changed. And, you know, by the time we figured it out, just to give you an idea, we noticed our revenue drop 55%. Looking at those numbers from any business person's perspective, you know, caused us to sit back and go, is this really a business that we want to be invested in long term? And that answer was quickly, not until we can figure out these algorithms and how to participate more profitably. So I concur. We're on hold. We haven't added a new property to that space, I guess, now for almost 2 years. So we're going to wait and see.
Was the silly behavior you mentioned, can you elaborate on that silly behavior
Sure.
of the large listing sites a bit?
Absolutely. So I'm sure there's a lot of books that I have not read, and I know the whole hotel industry by and large operates on kind of a profit by night or rental by night matrix. And so as that fluctuates, you want to be priced accordingly to the demand that's coming through your specific area. And so we all fell into the trap by both the bigger listing sites to turn on these features called smart pricing and dynamic pricing. And it sounded like a wonderful, thoughtful way to approach the business without having to add on back office software to make sure you knew what was going on in your region. Well, the way that algorithm was built is that it first took a look at any available nights on a calendar and offered them at your minimum price to see if it could generate a booking. Because, as you know, the way most of the listing sites are paid is a very small fraction of that booking revenue. So if they're in the game for 1% to 3%, do they really care if you're booking at $400 a night or $350 a night or even $300 a night? It's really pennies to them. And they have another book of constituents that they try and please, which is that traveler. And so they're trying to make a market to keep both sides happy, which you can completely, and I completely understand. But we felt like their revenue, what they accomplished in earning revenue, was booking nights. And the easiest way to book nights is to drive the price lower. So I just felt like they adversely selected all property owners that turned on smart pricing, because then we were immediately competing with one another, and it was a race to the bottom. And you think, well, Dave, why did it take you 6 months to figure that out? And I think you have a good point. But when we did figure it out, it's sort of amazing that we look back historically at kind of what our nightly rental rates were in 2015 and 2016. And I think I mentioned earlier, they were now making a market with these smart pricing tools that were almost 50, 60% lower. And so that really, really not only hurt our business, but then it took what I would call just a modeled nightly rate for an area, and it set it at this artificially low number. And then it set an expectation for that traveler that, hey, if I'm going to come to Anaheim, California, and I'm going to go to Disneyland, it looks like I can rent a three-bedroom place here for a couple $100 a night, which, you know, maybe, like you were saying, in the months that nobody wants to travel, I might offer my three-bedroom home for a couple $300 a night. But I certainly don't want to be doing that on holiday seasons or when demand in an area is increasing and the algorithm doesn't really account for any of those types of things. It's just going to offer the lowest rate and book the calendar up as quickly as possible. So did that make sense, Dan? I went on a while there, but that's where we felt we got sideways.
Yeah, it did 100% make sense. And it brings up an interesting point, which I think a lot of people, as they progress professionally, certainly myself, I've been in the real estate business now for 13 years or so. And then over the last, I don't know, 3 to 5 years, Dave, I really began to see, you know, I could read the other side of the table. So in any transaction, there's like a buyer, there's a seller, there may be an attorney for one or the other who's going to represent the interests of the other party. And I think that the better you are at quickly observing, you know, the interests aren't really aligned with you as the person who has the house. They're kind of more aligned with, you know, you're bringing the inventory and now you have this conflict of interest between you, the supplier of the inventory, and, you know, the traveler who's the one bringing the money to the table. And so they have to kind of keep both constituents happy here in this scenario. But I think like the broader lesson here for everybody listening is being better at analyzing the interests of the other side in any negotiation. I mean, almost anything you can think of, whether there's money involved or not, you know, being able to be aware of what the other people want, expect, are thinking, it just definitely opens up more doors and allows you to operate on a smarter and higher level.
So well said. And especially in our lending business, you know, we look so much at counterparty risk that I just, it's funny how much that's become part of our lives here over the last several years. So I agree with you 100%. And I think that's part of getting in the middle of a business, getting in the middle of a market, understanding, you know, what your goals are, and then starting to learn. And I know, or don't know, but I'm assuming you'd agree with me that where we are today is, you know, you still learn quite a bit about the intricacies of your market every day. And I completely agree with your comments there.
So you talked about in the mortgage business, this counterparty risk. Could you elaborate on exactly what you mean by that and how that's happened over the last few years in comparison to since 2008, maybe, as your business has changed a bit, Dave?
Oh, boy. I don't know how to keep this one short. But, you know, our business was, if not the most affected, it was certainly one of the most affected through this 2007-2008 crisis. And on the backside of that, or prior to that, you know, counterparty risk was something that was talked about, you know, in the way back offices of probably bond traders or rating agencies and just stuff that wasn't part of my daily vocabulary. Fast forwarding to what we do today, which is fix and flip financing. We do some long-term rental financing and we're making all of those decisions here in-house. Counterparty risk is part of understanding all parties, you know, or at least our interpretation and definition of it is understanding not only the contracts, but in these fix and flip financing transactions, you have a lot of moving parts. It's just, you know, not just a borrower and not just an asset. And there's contractors, there's subcontractors, there's inspectors, there's a lot of stuff moving. So we look a lot at, you know, holistically at that transaction and evaluate risk far more deeply than we would have prior to 08. I think in 08, it was really just, as you may remember, Dan, I'd say that the risk measure in totality prior to 08 was a FICO score. And you know, there's far more to it today.
Yeah, absolutely. I know myself, you know, I talk about risk or read a Warren Buffett book in my late 20s or something. I'm in my late 30s now. And I had no real concept. You know, I'd hear them talk about risk and it was just like, you know, risk, you know, it's a board game and okay, you risk some money and maybe you lose it. But when I was going into any one of these fix and flip deals, you know, from age 26 to 31, 32, probably 5 years or so. And that was also through that same dip in the market when we all got bludgeoned, which was a hell of a lesson in risk. But I never really would view the risk the same way. And the more deals I do and the more markets I look at, the more I understand the risk of things like the market changing, the risk of the neighborhood, the risk of the interest rates rising and, you know, putting downward pressure on buyer activity in a market, risk of the contractors running off with the deposit, risk of discovering more construction than we analyzed in our budget. So earlier investors, if they were like me in my mindset in the first couple of years, and you know, most, maybe a lot of them aren't if you didn't start at such an early age, I guess, I was blind to that risk. You know, I would take too much risk early on in comparison to how we do now. So the counterparty risk in the mortgage business, we talked a bit about that. We talked about the FICO scores kind of changing things. To try and paint a bit of a picture of where the market was, where the market is, and where we think you and I, maybe together on the same path, think the market's going to go in the next year or two, give me just some background brief answers here. What are the makeups of the makeup of loans that American Heritage Lending, your company, made over the last 12 months ending in 2019? Like what percentage FHA, what percentage were these fix and flip investor loans, and what percentage maybe were new construction versus what percentage were investor buy and hold type deals? And I don't need them to be like exact and put us on hold here to go get the secretary to give you the numbers, but just if you had to guess for 2018.
Great question. So I'd say upwards of 90% were all in this envelope that I would title, you know, real estate investor based loans. And of that, the bulk was fix and flip financing. We do some short-term bridge lending, you know, or what even I think a lot of viewers might call private money or hard money. The remaining balance, and it's a product I'm real excited about because I mentioned, you know, I think I actually was with my family, my first little rental house I purchased in 1991, and being an old beat up, you know, mortgage lender originator, 20% of the remaining loans we did were in this long-term rental category. And what's specific about that, it's a product that we developed with this hedge fund that we're partnered with. And it looks at the asset first and it says, you know, what is the rental income versus the debt service? And if that looks good, then almost like a commercial underwrite, Dan, that they're looking at the economics of that asset, supported by, you know, a borrower's experience and even a borrower's credit worthiness. But it isn't like one of these situations, and you know, as an investor, where if you go get a traditional loan, you're asked for 2 years tax returns and pay stubs and bank statements, and they're looking at your debt to income ratio, and it is extremely difficult to qualify for those loans even today. This is an opportunity for folks that are professional real estate investors to look at, I guess to sum it up, it's a way to underwrite those single family homes and condos as, or similar to how you would underwrite a commercial loan. Much, much simpler.
What would be the loan to values and down payment requirements and seasoning, if any at all, on some of these loans? And is it different for a refinance versus a purchase acquisition on this long-term rental loan, Dave?
It is different. So we're gonna cap the cash out in that 65, you know, some rare cases, 70% loan to value. The purchase money can actually go as high as 80% in this program. And again, we're kind of looking at it really as a debt service coverage ratio. And so all that really means is, you know, we're primarily looking for this to be a positive cash flow investment. But the leverage rates are high, you know, 70, 80% LTV, and the rates are very, very similar to your conventional financing. So if you and I could agree that today, you know, a non-owner occupied investment property with Fannie Mae is going to be in the high fives. You know, these loans are in kind of the mid to high sixes. So I think they've created an opportunity for a professional investor to participate without all the gory paperwork and details required to qualify. And then, you know, I don't know if you've ever been hung up on it, but if you have a certain number of finance properties that you own, you're limited on how much more you can borrow with those entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So that there aren't even those caps and adjustments in this product. So we're really excited about this loan, and I think it's helpful for the guys that are fix and flipping too, that decide, hey, I might have bought so well that when I'm done with my project, I want to put some long-term financing in place on a 30-year deal where I know I don't have interest rate risk, and I'm going to put a renter in here, and I'm going to ride it out.
What's the longest term and amortization of the payment schedule, Dave?
We have one product that I can't believe more folks haven't bid on, but we have a 40-year amortization with an IO payment. So when you talk about using leverage at a really low cost, you know, now you're looking at a payment amount so we don't exaggerate, let me say that it's equal to a payment that you'd be paying with a traditional, you know, conventional A paper type loan.
Wait a minute. So you said they amortize it over 40 years?
They do. Yeah.
And what's the term? They're expecting us to refinance out at what, 5 years, 10 years?
Most of these, you know, so that's the piece of the business I don't get involved in is really the, you know, I would call it the back end analytics. But I think their studies show that most people are going to stay in these loans between 5 and 7 years.
Well, are they written into the paperwork that it's only 5 or 7 years? I mean, I get like commercial loans all the time and it's usually 5 years, but is that like a 40-year fixed and 40-year term?
It is, and it starts amortizing over, I think it's in the remaining, or it's in the final 20 years, it goes fully amortized.
How about that? That is quite an interesting product. So you've done at least a few of those loans, or no one at all wanted to try the product?
Nobody wants to try it. The flavor of the day is 30-year fixed, and I think is indicative of 2008, 2009 lending. There wasn't a borrower that you talked to that could stomach a 5-year fixed, you know, on these adjustable rates, even with fixed terms. So I haven't been able to do one yet. Maybe you'll be my first, Dan. You sound like you're interested.
I'm a conservative guy, so I probably have like 50% loan to value on my stuff. Half of it's paid off, and I paid cash to begin with for those. I don't care for the rental properties all that much. I'm a mostly fix and flip guy. We do 180 to 200 deals a year in the three markets we're in. So I kind of got to stay nimble and not hang on to too much of the rental properties. It tends to a lot of paperwork, inspections, even with the management company, it still can be arduous. You as well as the audience listening knows that these rentals can be a high maintenance anyway, cut the deck. But the bottom line is, you said a 30-year fixed rate at 6.5%, 7%, and it's a 30-year term, so I don't have to go through the paperwork and the refinance of, like I do on my commercial loans with the smaller banks. It's a 5-year term or a 10-year term with an adjustment on the rate after 5 years. So you're telling me fixed rate, 30-year term, 30-year amortization is kind of the going term sheet, for lack of a better word, on these loans. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. That's where we filled up the remaining 20%. And I think 2019, I think it'll be a significant part of our business.
And I assume they'll do a portfolio of 8 or 10 of them in an LLC and give you one payment, or are they going to want to write 10 different loans on there?
So I'm going to answer that today, and then I'll tell you that is, we've been discussing that over and over and over. The blanket loan concept is kind of foreign, because a lot of these are being sold off as, you know, bonds. They're getting securitized. So currently they're all done as individual loans, but we are, you know, there has been a lot of discussion around a blanket loan product.
Is there a minimum loan amount, Dave?
So you got to remember I'm in California, and I don't want to upset anybody, but you know, our minimum loan amounts are typically $75,000. So I know that's going to, you know, exclude some folks, but, you know, things change. So we're working on that too.
Yeah, I'd say it's better anyway to get that out, you know, right up front. Because at the end, you know, at the end of our time, if I ask you to share some contact info, you want somebody to be the right person who's raising their hand and looking for a loan. So you mentioned that it's difficult to qualify for these conventional loans. I bought a house this year, condo, earlier, I guess last year, now it's 2019, and it was a pain. It was the pay stubs. It was the go down and get this form signed at the IRS. It was the verification of such and such, and it was all the paperwork, you know, needed. And it's the same thing when I've done all of my refinances for my rental properties that I've bought over the last couple years as well. So I know it's been difficult to qualify for the loans. And for me, that was evidence of a more stable market continuing. You know, a lot of people in my circles, I don't know about yours, Dave, but they're kind of, oh, yeah, it's going to be another crash. The crash is coming. I'm not flipping any house. I'm not doing anything because this crash is coming. And they're like, you know, they're waiting for 2008 to happen all over again. And if I look at the underwriting that happened over the past 3 years in my own personal experience of the properties I bought compared to the underwriting that I experienced in 2007 and 8 when all of that took place, I would say, well, there's probably a lot of safeguards in place and there weren't anywhere near the number of idiotic loans made. Certainly not as many, if not any, with the time bomb of the adjustable rate. So I'm like kind of voting and saying that I'm expecting like a stable, more normalized market, similar to like 1998, 99, 2000, before stuff started going nuts. I'm thinking more in that kind of market right now. What would be your opinion, and do you have any observations on what's going on in the market, U.S.-wide, not necessarily just California, Dave?
So I'm about 10 years older than you, and so I remember the market you're speaking of. And, you know, in traveling to various conferences to give me more of a national idea of where people think the market's at versus just sort of a regional one, everyone's sort of saying the same thing. And Dan, I agree with you. You know, there's no doubt here in my local markets and most markets where we make loans, it has flattened, meaning, you know, it's not, properties aren't selling like hotcakes, going up double digits every year. In some specific areas, we've seen softening. And I'd say that means price reductions. I don't necessarily know that it means market values have gone down. So in totality, I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying that the spark is not there to light a fire for a massive downturn and correction like we saw in 07 and 08. And I'm also agreeing with you that I think in certain pockets, you know, there'll be certain pockets that are stronger and weaker, but I'd say overall flat to, I mean, I guess if I had to bet here in 2019, we might go down slightly, but I can tell you that rally in rates that the conventional markets felt in December, has certainly brought more buyers out, locally. People are starting to call me who told me last year they are not going to do any more deals, that they're thinking about doing deals. So I know we have a lot of sensitivity to those rates, and it looks like they're going to kind of stay in this pattern. So maybe it's just going to be a stable market.
Yeah. And one of the things I observed is we flip houses. So the stuff that we put together, you know, recently, just in the last 6 months, we've sold it very, very fast. So with the exception of there's neighborhoods like in Philadelphia where the tracks are gentrifying, so there's actually a lot of renovated inventory in those areas. And so buyers have a ton of selection in that specific neighborhood I'm talking about, because it went from, you know, being a sub $50,000-$60,000 for a house to a renovated house selling for $200,000-$400,000. And so there's obviously a lot of turnover activity, rehab business going on. There's been going on there for 15 or 20 years in the Fishtown neighborhood. But when we sell property there, it took a lot longer to sell, and we had to do some price reductions. And there was times when you could set records and have the bidding wars for the newly renovated inventory there. So I've witnessed our slowing and changing the price there. But I'm also flipping houses in the Atlanta market, which is red hot still. It's flattened, but there's still low inventory there, and flipping houses in, you know, Chicago metropolitan area. And in Chicago and Atlanta, we see the renovated product still selling very, very quickly, and it also being very limited in the sense that there's not a lot of other renovated inventory that's available. So the renovated inventory that does come on the market is selling relatively quick. Have you done any fix and flips, you know, in the last 12 months yourself, Dave, with any kind of observations like that?
So that's interesting to hear. And that's what I am hearing, you know, kind of across the country. And so to answer your question, we have, you know, everybody wants to flip in the area that's right next door to them or where they have crews. So in my backyard, we have kind of a double-edged sword for my risk tolerance. And that is we have very high prices and we also have very low availability of product that you can buy right such that you can spend the money you need to spend with labor rates out here to get them in a position where you can make a profit at sale. So we haven't done a fix and flip in the last 12 months. We've certainly lent on plenty. And our margins, you know, the margins we're seeing out here are so, so different than the margins you're seeing there that I'm too nervous to do deals here today with the margins that we're seeing.
Yeah, and that's fair. And my guess, right, is I look at I grew up in Philadelphia. I moved to Chicago about 4 years ago so I could be near my daughter out here while she's finishing high school and all that before she heads off to college. That was why I went into Chicago, and then I figured out to go into other markets, and I went into Atlanta and a few others and failed out of those, but still in those three. I have this theory. Philadelphia is a solid market. There's a lot of inventory. There's a lot of older distressed inventory there. And the prices in general, they seem to be about half what the houses go for out here in Chicago. And that's like when you stretch into the counties around Chicago as well. My theory, or my hypothesis, I guess, is that Chicago has had a long time of being in like a financial seat where we have people with like a ton of money. There's like really high income earners in the city who are making like tons of money in the financial markets, who have done some risky, there's like friends of my attorneys and stuff who do these like deals just to talk about the fact that they're flipping this $1 million condo downtown, or, you know, flipping this nice 4,500 square foot, whatever it is. And they're making $40,000 or $50,000 on a transaction that might need like $1.4 million altogether. And I'm guessing that Southern California might have a lot of cheap money, Silicon Valley, you know, there's a giant money pool swirling around in the market to kind of like feed these. These are not the kind of entrepreneurial flips that you and I and everybody listening to this show right now gets into. We're looking for 70% of the ARV minus repairs or better. We don't want to lose money. If the market changes, we still want to make a profit, or at least worst case scenario, break even. So that was kind of my little theory I had as far as like the differences in many of the other markets. When you have a New York City with national money coming from all over the world of financial capital, it's very hard to play, and you'll see like much higher prices in New York City, as you'll see in Southern California, as you'll see in the Chicago market compared to some of the other markets like, you know, Dallas, Texas. There's money, but there's a ton of real estate without limitations, and you don't really see the same, in my opinion, like overvaluation of the properties, right?
Absolutely. And I've tried, you know, I don't know if it's the proliferation of HGTV and the flip and flop and all the different stuff that people are watching, or if it's the really, really big income earners, like you mentioned, or, you know, I had a hypothesis, I'll share mine, that it was sort of this law of large numbers. So, you know, if I could figure out a way to buy $1 million property, spend $100,000 fixing it up, and sell it for, you know, 1.4, and after costs and whatever, I could get out with $100,000, even a little bit less, that $100,000 was meaningful enough as a profit number that it drove the behavior. And I like yours better. So I'm going to trade my hypotheses, and I'm going to go with yours, because what mine didn't take into account was that there was really any handicapping of what a traditional model might look for. And you mentioned that, right? We want to be at 70% or less ARV. And it's really hard to do that on the buy side when you look at properties in the $1 million range. So I'm going to go with your theory that there's people with really, 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 really big, big pocketbooks, and they're doing it for sport or fun or to tell a story at a cocktail party, or I don't know. But it's not me. I'm too conservative.
Yeah, you and me both. So let's talk about why we have to be conservative, and that would be, give me an example of how to fund these fix and flip deals with some of those fix and flip products that you have: interest rate, down payment, term, etc.
So being an institutional class lender, our capital does come from Wall Street, and so we like to be very competitive in the rate environment. And our leverage points today, we're very traditional in the sense that we will lend, up to 85% loan to cost. We want to make sure that is with an after repaired value less than 70. And I know you say, wow, and we feel the same way, but you'd be surprised how many people call every day and they want, they even want more leverage. So if it's a higher leverage deal, we are going to look at the borrower's experience, track record, profitable recent transactions in the last 12 months. We're going to take a look at creditworthiness. So, of course, we know that they're buying in an entity. We're going to do a little bit of research on that entity. But, our rates, Dan, are probably on the lower end, starting in that 9%. For 12 months, interest-only payments. So our view of the business is we're looking for folks that make a living out of it, and we look at ourselves as partners in their enterprise. Because earlier in the podcast, you talked about profitability models and kind of feasibility studies and certain parts of neighborhoods and knowing what's a good deal and what's a bad deal and putting in some overruns for construction. We're doing all that as well when we, underwrite our own files. So I think there's some value in having somebody be, a debt partner, so to speak, and coming alongside and running some analysis and if for nothing else, it's a bit of an accountability partner, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, Dave. So like where I'm at today, doing 180, 200 deals, like a lot of times the product that you guys have, it's going to be arduous for me. I move quick. I have a list of people who lend money. I actually pay 10% and 2 points to my private lenders, which is expensive. I'm sure you almost could maybe give it to me cheaper than that. No, there's like a lot of options out there. And a lot of times for us, like we're just front the construction out of pocket, lender might do like 100% of the deal and then we'll front the call. Sometimes they're including the budget, et cetera. We do so many that, we're making money and we're kind of doing the best deals. We're keeping the cosmetic flips, et cetera. But if I were in a position to start over again and go back to 2006, and I even did, I was paying 5 points and 15% interest to my lenders back then. But to have somebody to lean on and kind of like co-underwrite the deal for me, there's value in that. To have somebody who's going to put the money on the table, like I mentioned earlier in our show here, where we talked about risk and how I didn't understand that. In the first 3-4 years, I would take a deal to, a hard money guy, someone like yourself, and they would say, no, this is not a deal for this and this. And I'd kind of be like pissed off because the guy didn't want to fund it. But looking back, I probably didn't do quite a few deals that would have lost even more money when 2007-08, when the crash finally did come. I would have been bludgeoned much worse had it not been for, the people who had control of the purse strings doing the hard money lending, like yourself, sort of helping to be a governor on the deal and control the flow of it so that I don't get too far out of control. So there's definitely some value in there. And that's kind of what you were saying you're offering to some of these bars. You're sort of hand-holding, sort of being accountable, sort of shutting down the deals they're not going to make any money on, right, Dave?
Well, right, Dan. And wouldn't you have liked, I mean, you know, I think in anything that you look at in business that's a repetitive process, wouldn't you have loved somebody to tell you, you know, getting, you know, I guess you could say one bad deal is going to require, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I just love this cliche. It's going to take 10 good deals to dig you out of that hole. And that's not just financial. That's your psyche. That's your confidence. And so, you know, would you at least like the accountability of somebody else saying, gosh, you know, a year ago, I had a guy that told me the same numbers right around the corner from you. And here's what happened. And it's just perspective I would have loved to have had as a younger man, too, that bad deals hurt a lot worse than just losing some bucks.
Yeah, you're right about that. Well, I think we covered everything I was looking for on my end. Is there any questions or topics or comments that you have, Dave, that you think we should talk about or that you'd want to share with the audience before we get to our wrap up here?
No, it's really been a pleasure to hear your story and how you got started and surviving the meltdown. And I'm envious you're still able to find 180 deals a year. I thank you for having me on the show and have really, really enjoyed myself.
Cool. So I have a couple wrap-up questions here, and it costs. I mean, our company has like $100,000 a month marketing budget to keep the deals rolling in all these markets with like 12 or 14 partners, I think, all together now. So it's not easy to have that kind of volume. And I don't know. I mean, there's something to be said for not necessarily growing to the size that Diamond Equity Investments, our company, has grown to. For investors listening, you know, that may not be the best goal to reach for, but a goal of doing, I don't know, 3-4 quality $40,000, maybe $50,000 profit deals, maybe 5 deals at $35,000 each. I mean, that's nice, manageable. You're not like spinning too many plates at once. You're not taking too much risk. And if Dave's helping, if you're helping them underwrite it, you're making good money on the deals and you're not making any bad ones. Like 3-5 deals could be a hugely life-changing, freeing, you know, flexible schedule, lifestyle design kind of business and goal. So yeah, 180 is head spinning sometimes, but enough about that. I got a question here for you, Dave. Answer it two ways. I'm going to ask book recommendations. The first way would be like real estate related for somebody maybe just getting started. And then a second recommendation for maybe somebody you might make to myself or somebody who's been doing business in real estate for a long time.
Oh, wow. So I'm going to take pause on the real estate book. I'm not really sure that I have a great recommendation, but one for you. And one that I just picked up last year again, I think I've read it 3 times, and it's so simple, but go out and read Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And if you haven't read it recently or you have, you know, that's probably one we all should read every other year. Gosh, there's nothing that comes to my mind real estate related. Richest Man in Babylon. Have you read that one?
That's a good one. Yeah, I think that's definitely one everybody should read for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
And
sorry,
and Think and Grow Rich. No, we're all good. Think and Grow Rich is a great one. I am, brief story, but my call center manager, so we have a call center and all the incoming leads are handled by the gentleman named Josh there. He's young. He's in his early 20s and we've been friends for a while. And then he came to work for the company and started doing that about a year ago. And I recommended Think and Grow Rich to him. And it was like a night and day difference. All of a sudden, he was just like completely new person, so professional, had all these ideas. It was like a light switch flipped and on went a spotlight, like one of those spotlights with the Batman symbol, like a bright light came on. It was like amazing to see the transformation in Josh over just the period of time when he picked up. He found the book, Dave, in like a secondhand bookstore, and he's like, he was going to buy it, and he was embarrassed to buy the book. And he called me, he texted me, and I missed the text, and he was almost like asking for me to vouch for him to buy the book. And I'm sure there's people who felt that way, feel a little stupid as you like first, you know, pick up these sales books or Think and Grow Rich or something, and you and I are like way past that feeling now. but it was interesting to see Josh have it. I'm like, oh my God, you got to get the book. No, go back, get it. And he ended up getting it a week or two later. He read it and it was like, it's been one ever since. So it's like great recommendation. If you have not checked that out, circle back, check it out again for sure. So Dave, if you could go back, I'm going to guess you were probably around 30 years old or so in 2001 when you started with that buy and hold deal. If you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with your 30-year-old self, what would that be?
So I think that the crown jewel is you got to stick with your gut. I tried a lot of things, which is fine too, but as an entrepreneur, you know, I bought things, I sold things, I tried different businesses, and my 30-year-old self probably could have benefited more by the just keep putting one foot in front of the other. And as that relates to real estate, you know, if the long-term rental game wasn't for you, it doesn't mean, real estate's not for you. Try a flip, try a vacation rental, try something else. I don't think I was served well by starting and then stopping and leaving in a market for a period of time and then going back into the market. So I'd say stick with it, stay persistent, find something that you like that works for you. And that would have served me best.
Yeah, well said, Dave. Staying focused has changed my life. And if I could say that anything happened over the last 5 years that changed the trajectory of my company, it was there the whole time. I went broke in 2008, 2009. It took me till 2012 to regain that focus and turn the company into the deal machine it is today. So yeah, great, great jewel of wisdom there. I wish I could go back and tell myself that at the beginning. Cool. Contact info, Dave. Do you want to share a website, any contact info, if anyone wants to reach out about some of those wild loans we were talking about, or just maybe to fix and flip stuff? Is there some way they can get in contact with you?
Of course. So my email is easy. It's dave@ahlend.com. A is in Apple, H is in Henry, lend.com. And our toll-free number is 800-731-9226. Love to chat with anybody about real estate. It's what we love to do. So thank you for that opportunity. And again, thank you so much, Dan, for having me on the show.
For sure, Dave. I really appreciate you coming on, giving of your time and all the stuff we talked about today. Some real interesting products you brought to the table as well. And I think we give the listeners here some good value. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. If you are interested in reaching out directly, please do so using the Contact Dan link at reidiamonds.com. I personally monitor and reply to all requests through that site. That's www.reidiamonds.com. Also at that site, you can check out the other 125 content-packed episodes on a variety of real estate investment topics, ranging from flipping houses to new construction to flipping land to buying hundreds and even thousands of multifamily apartment units and so on. The most common feedback I receive from my listeners is appreciation for my direct, no BS interview style delivered from my perspective as CEO of Diamond Equity Investments, a real estate investment company flipping between 150 and 200 houses per year. Would you be interested in passively participating in some of those fix and flip deals as a private lender? Our average deal pays 2 points and 10% interest and returns capital in 6 to 12 months. If so, go to www.fundrehabdeals.com for details and sign up to receive the private mortgage investment opportunities via email. Oh, and I am always buying houses and I am always looking for deals in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia. So if you have a deal, preferably one I can fix and flip, although I will look at the buy and hold and multifamily deals as well, please send me details using the Contact Dan link at reidiamonds.com. Keep an eye out for the next episode. I've invited a partner of mine here in Chicago, Saul Z, to share his experience in flipping between 5 and 10 houses per month. If you're interested in hearing a bit of my own business model and how it works, you'll definitely want to catch that one. as Saul is in a very similar space as myself. And that concludes this week's episode. I appreciate you once again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. Catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.